listening to Broke and How to Fix It with Bobby Siegel.
Welcome to Broke and How to Fix It on FUBAR Radio with me, your host, Bobby Siegel. I am a maths teacher and used to work in investment banking and chartered accountancy, and I'm now here trying to share my knowledge and experience of the world of money and personal finance, because every Monday at 4 p.m. we look at the big questions going around personal finance and trying to break down some of the issues that impact younger and older listeners, and we get the wisdom of a range of experts and famous faces sharing their own personal finance journeys. And this week is no different. We've got Fee Titus, who's the founder of Coco Financial. We've got Kylie Scarlatta, a debt influencer, and Jake Humphreys, the well-known broadcaster and entrepreneur. And this week is all about debt. And don't run away. Don't run away. It's not boring. It's important. It's about debt. And is it all bad? Debt isn't just a financial issue. It's something that can spark emotions, and it even can be generational. Because if you look at the stats in the UK, the average adult carries around $4,200 in unsecured debt. And this is your credit cards, your loans, your buy now, pay later. So that's quite a sizable number. But if you look at generations, you go to younger people, debt isn't actually just unusual, it's pretty much normalized. And Gen Z are, unfortunately, the first generation where this is expected to be worse off than their parents. And you've got other things like the buy now, pay later. And this has absolutely exploded, and millions of people are using it without really thinking about it as debt, because psychologically, you know, these are small payments, maybe £30, but the hidden cost of this could be large. And I think with debt, the reason why it's a challenging issue is that it can be linked to your mental health, because stress about finances is probably one of the biggest drivers of individual anxiety and even anxiety in relationships. And I think the real issue isn't that people have debt. Debt in itself isn't necessarily good or bad, but it's that people are ashamed to talk about it and they feel a taboo. But it's not all doom and gloom. I think it's changing. With Gen Z in particular, I feel as if they are more open to talking about money struggles. And hopefully today we will lift the lid on debt for you. Coming up on this week's show, we've got a terrific trio for you. We've got Fee Titus, the founder of Coco Financial. We have Kylie Scarlatta, a debt influencer, and Jake Humphreys, the well-known broadcaster and entrepreneur. We're really delighted this week to welcome a fellow chartered accountant onto the podcast, because I qualified as a chartered accountant myself at PwC. We've got someone from a rival Big Four firm. We're allowing that on Broke and How to Fix It. So a big welcome to Fee Titus, who is a chartered accountant. She founded Coco Financial and also recently co-founded Finio, a tech startup, as it were, tech fin startup.
Yeah.
So we want to talk about debt and your perspective, because obviously you are a qualified chartered accountant, so you've seen it from a business side on behalf of others, but now as an entrepreneur, has working in accounting changed the way that you think about debt?
Absolutely. I would say, you know, growing up, you just assume that debt equals bad.
Everyone hears the word like, oh my God, someone's in debt.
Exactly. You think of it as such a negative thing, and actually sort of seeing behind the scenes in finance and accounting, mm-hmm. you realize that the world's biggest businesses, they use debt for leverage to grow and to further themselves.
And countries as well.
Entire countries as well. Now, obviously, debt can be bad, mm-hmm. but it's not inherently bad. Mm. Debt is technically neutral.
Yes.
The application and how you use it can either be positive or negative. So I think understanding almost our cultural understanding of debt,
yes.
The way we think about it is not as black and white as we think it is.
Thank you. That's a really interesting nuance between there's good debt, bad debt, but also in itself, it's neutral.
Yeah.
So in terms of different types of debts, are there some that fall into the potential bracket of good debts and potential brackets of bad debts?
Yeah, of course. And I would say, so something like a mortgage is typically viewed as a good debt. The reason being you have taken on debt to acquire something that is an asset. So over time, typically people get a 25, 30 year mortgage. Over time of paying that off, it should appreciate in value.
Yes.
And you feel like you're getting something for that. Whereas perhaps if you took on something that maybe would be in the bad debt camp, that would be credit card debt for maybe something that you consume and can't get back. So if you use credit cards to pay for a big slap up meal and a holiday, by all means, do that if you can afford to pay it off.
Of course.
But if you can't afford to pay that off, in a, you know, within a month or without incurring much interest, at that point it's considered a bad debt because the interest rates are so high that you are not getting good value for what you have got, and there's no asset that remains afterwards to kind of show for it.
Yeah, debt can be a financial tool that's useful. Where is the boundary from when it becomes dangerous?
I think it becomes dangerous the moment the repayments and the interest sort of snowballs. It gets to a point where the payments that you are making to pay that debt down are actually hardly scratching the surface. They're pretty much just paying off the interest, not even the principal. And that's actually something that has been touched on quite a lot with the type 2 student loans that have come out recently. Now, inherently, student loans have often been put in the good camp, like you've managed to get a degree out of
well
it.
You
don't have to pay it back sort of in the same way as traditional debt.
That's
it's almost like a tax. But here's an example of when the interest snowballs to the point that you can't actually pay it down. That's when it's a challenging, difficult, dangerous situation.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. Again, many of our listeners will be thinking about their student loans and thinking, should I have gone to uni? Probably, but yeah, it's definitely the calculations now changing for younger people.
Yeah.
So we're going to look at mindsets with money and sort of approaches and attitudes, because when it comes to debt, again, people instinctively think it's bad, but there's also a shame in general about money that people have in this country. Where do you think the money shame comes from?
It's so interesting, isn't it? You're right. Culturally, like we don't talk about our salaries. We don't talk
taboo,
about how much how much something cost, and everyone's pretending that they bought the house by themselves.
Yeah.
That their bank and mum and dad didn't.
Like, have you seen the ads on telly where it might be Zoopla, where someone's at a party and they're like, "How much did this house cost?" And everyone's like, "Oh my god, they asked this question." It's such a taboo, isn't it?
It is such a taboo, and we just need to be more transparent and comfortable talking about money, because actually, a lot of issues come from money. I think most divorces are related to finances, and we just don't have a good grip as a nation on speaking about money. I think where it comes from is that the idea is that it's seen as this thing that is associated with poverty. A lot of people are maybe using credit to look wealthy, but actually it becomes this sort of big cycle. But the truth is, some of the richest people on the planet and organizations use debt to their leverage. So we just have to understand that there's no inherent shame with having debt. There can be shame attached with letting it get out of control. The reason being, if it's out of control and it snowballs and a large chunk of your disposable income is going on paying something off that feels like it's not even going down, then it starts to affect the quality of your life. And when it affects the quality of your life, you're realizing you can't go out for dinner with your friends. You can't go on a holiday. You're starting to choose between, do I pay down this debt or do I let it spiral? And I think the shame lies in that dynamic and that nuance there, that tension between clearing it and living life. The average salary in the UK at the moment is around the sort of mid-30s, mid-30Ks, around there. But the average non-mortgage debt that a UK adult holds is around just under 20K. So that is a significant portion. That's, you know, pretty much two-thirds, if not more, of your annual income is in debt. I think if people understood that that was the average, and most people did, you know, 85% of UK adults have debts. And I'm not saying that we should celebrate that, but I think everyone should realize that we are a nation that runs on credit, and there is debt everywhere. And so there needn't be a stigma around that. And I mean, I'm a chartered accountant. I've had
debt. Yeah, and if you were like, Fee's in a chartered accountant, she must be fine.
Yeah, like I've, you know, I definitely had, especially, you know, leaving a stable career, yes, trying something new, you need some form of credit to kind of see you through that if you don't have oodles of cash, which I didn't at the time.
Yes.
And so I have had debts. I have gone through the pain of paying it down, working out which bit you pay down first. How do you get over the other side?
Mm-hmm.
And then you do, and you realize it's a page in the story and not your entire story.
I like that. Just a single page. That's, I love that exactly. approach. So when we're talking about the gender wealth gap, do you think that's a real thing? And is it getting better between men and women?
It's getting worse.
It's getting worse. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Particularly around pensions. So... Okay. 44%, no, it's 44% less, yeah. Women, UK women, retire with 44% less in pension savings than men.
That's a huge gap.
Yeah, that's increased from previously. I think it was around 37% before. And on average, women live 8 years longer than men. So that
men
is...
we do silly things. And
so that's less money to live off of for longer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the statistics are showing that increase is actually getting worse. It's not a fake thing. It's a very, very real thing. And I think it starts with financial education at the starting point. Then there's an obvious section that happens in people's lives, which is typically around care, where women tend to earn less once you get to sort of a typical family age, often because of maternity leave.
Yes, of course.
Taking time off, maybe being part-time for children. Now, we live in a modern world. Mm-hmm. Not every family looks like that, but more do than don't, which is what's skewing that data. And then it's compounded when it gets to maybe later on in life, often... daughters take on the lion's share of parental care more so than sons. And again, there is this gender divide, and it's often around care at the infant spectrum and the elderly care spectrum that has an impact on earning potential, essentially, or the amount of income that's being brought in. And the more income you have, the more you can save and invest. And
again,
more
and the compounding of that over time. So if there are Gen Z women listening to our show, what should they specifically know about money so they can try to reduce this gap for themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Take your pension seriously from day one. I wish I had started saving into my pension when I was in nappies, honestly. Knowing what I know now. but seriously, it's, you know, you've got time. If you're Gen Z, you have time on your side for compounding to do its thing. I'm not saying don't, you know, go part-time, don't take time off for children. Like, when that time in life comes, you'll make the right choice that your family requires. But think about these things in advance. Have conversations with your partner. If you are the child birthing parent, can the non-birthing parent contribute to your pension while you're off? Because a UK adult can, I think, put £2,880 into another UK adult's pension per year, and the government will top it up with a free 25% bonus. Like, these are conversations that I think are often missing during that period in time.
So the thing is, again, that's such a valuable tip for listeners. And then with young people, why do they seem to be ignoring pensions?
Because it seems so far away and everybody thinks they're never going to get old.
Yeah.
And pensions just sound a bit boring.
Maybe it just needs a rebrand.
It needs a total rebrand. Yeah. Like, I honestly, they are... If people knew how much free money you get from pensions, I think they need to call it the free money pot. And then
the
people
free
will
money,
listen.
Yeah, they go, have you invested in your free money pot?
Exactly. Yeah. And the reason I'm saying that, like, it's not clickbait. There is so much free money attached to pensions. Yeah. So an example is, if you have a workplace pension, like a typical one, you might put in 5%. Your employer puts in 3%. Like, if you opt out, you're leaving that money on the table separately. If you invest personally into a pension, the government tops it up by 25%.
It's free money.
It's just free money. Like, it's, so if you want to invest £100 into a pension, you only need to put £80 in, because the government will top up the extra 20 if you're a basic rate payer.
Yes.
If you are a higher or additional rate taxpayer, they'll even give you a rebate, cash back. So there is literally so many ways to access free money. And You've heard it here first. Pensions are being rebranded as the free money
pot. We're calling that, yeah. So for self-employed people who are thinking about their free money pots, aka pensions, why is it such a problem for those on self-employment?
Such a great question. Mm. I think what happens is you go from maybe being in a typical employment status whereby your employer has set you up, they've done the legwork. Yes. They have set you up in a pension because of auto-enrollment.
Yes.
You've opted in. They are paying in, you're paying in, and it's all automated.
Yes.
You don't have to think about it. It's just happening. You then leave to start your side hustle that then gets really, you know, gets a lot of traction, and
yes.
your side hustle suddenly becomes your main hustle.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you are the head of HR, the social media intern, the head of sales. You are everything in the business.
Yes.
And you have forgotten that as the head of HR yourself, you're in charge of looking after your own future wealth too. It's one of the last things people think about when you're trying to test out your branding,
course,
get a new customer. And because it's one of the last things thought about, it is just so typical for an entrepreneur to finally be like, do you know what? No one's paid into my pension for the last 7 years. What am I going to do about that? It's just such a second thought.
Yeah.
But actually, by not thinking about it when you first start your business, is to do yourself a disservice, because time in the market is better than timing the market. And if you've
I love that, time in the market is better than timing the
market. Yeah, absolutely. And if you have had a significant time out of the market for your investments to grow, you're going to find sort of that stilted journey for yourself.
Gosh, that is such a sharp message that people need to understand. So if someone's a sole trader and they're thinking about moving towards being a limited company for their business, as it were, what is a misunderstanding that they might have?
Oh, the biggest misunderstanding I see is that sole traders, because there's no distinction between you and the business, you as the individual and your business is one and the same, is understanding that a limited company is a separate legal entity.
Yeah.
Even if you are the sole director, it is a separate legal entity. And as a result, you can only pay yourself in three specific ways. And that is a director salary, director dividends, if there are enough profits,
of course,
or a director's loan, which you would technically have to pay back. And seeing that tension between those who have been a sole trader before with a little bit more flow and control, can I say, on how sort of cash flow moves between the business funds and their own funds, that's quite a hurdle. And I see people get it wrong a lot. Once they get it wrong, they don't get it wrong a second time because of how painful it is,
Gosh,
how many taxes they owe from making that mistake.
Yes.
But that's one of the most common first-year mistakes I see with limited company directors.
Gosh, okay. But are there other tax mistakes that a small business owner might make?
Oh, plenty. And I think the biggest one is just simply not saving for tax as you go along. You know,
you often hear that on social media, someone getting a big tax bill for their business because they've not anticipated it.
Yeah, and I think it's often because people assume that cash equals profits. Because in simple terms, it technically does. You know, I charge somebody £1,000 for a service. It cost me £300 to deliver it. So there should be £700 left in my bank account as cash and profit. But cash is all about timing. Somebody might not pay you for 30 days, or they might pay you late. Like, you might have to pay for services up front before you've incurred it. And before you know it, your cash balance does not equal your profit balance. And people get very blindsided by that.
Gosh, okay. This is really valuable advice here. So the final thing is, what one thing should every young entrepreneur do with their money right now after this chat?
Oh, so one thing they should do with their money. Oh, that's such a big question. And I'm only allowed to pick one thing.
You've got your free pension pot. You've got stock markets.
Specifically, if you're an entrepreneur, I would just say make sure you are looking at your cash flow. So with your money, make sure you are looking at how cash flows in and out of your business.
Yes.
Because revenue is almost like a vanity metric. They say that profit is a sanity metric, so you can stay sane knowing.
You've got great statements. You've got great phrases.
But cash, everybody says cash is king, but I like to say cash is queen.
Okay, I like that.
Cash is queen.
Yeah.
Look at how your cash flows in and out of your business. That is how you stay afloat, abundant, and prosperous.
Oh, I love this. Thank you so much, Fee Titus. Your interview had so many nuggets, so many T-shirts. for people that like their finance-related slogans. So if you wanted to follow your journey afterwards, where can they keep in touch with you?
Yep, on Instagram as fee_financial. Yeah. If anyone wants to reach out on LinkedIn, it's my government name, Afia, A-F-I-Y-A, but everybody calls me Fee.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Fee Titus. He's a chartered accountant who founded Coco Financial and also has recently co-founded Finio, a tech startup. Thank you so much for coming on Broke and How to Fix It.
Thank you so much.
It's time for a short break, but you want to tune in for this because we've got Kylie Scarlatta from across the pond, who is a debt influencer.
Broke and How to Fix It with Bobby Siegel.
So now on Broke on How to Fix It, we have Kylie Scarlatta, who is a debt influencer from across the pond in America, in Wisconsin. And last year, Kylie was actually $27,000 in debt across four different credit cards and was actually forced to file for bankruptcy. How did you build up that $27,000 of debt in the first place?
Yeah, so right when I turned 18, I basically discovered that I could get a credit card. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, it was kind of, you know, the mentality of solely for emergencies, you know, only when I need it. And then it slowly started to become like, oh, if I was out and wanted to get food, kind of need it. So like, I'll just put it on there. And then it started to become, instead of like a set emergency thing, it kind of became more of a casual card. And then it sort of transitioned and kind of spiraled into using that as like my debit card instead of like my actual debit card.
Okay. How did it become two, three, then four credit cards? Was that like planned or just like suddenly came out of the blue?
It came out of the blue. It wasn't planned at all. Okay. I think with the amount that I had on one card, as the balance was going up, it was like, okay, I'm just going to pay this off, but let me have a second one, like, you know, with like a clean slate so I can really use this one for just, you know, sole specific purposes. And then that kind of like spiraled into one thing. So I feel like I would go in a state of trying to take accountability, but then I would kind of go back into the same cycle to kind of like start fresh in a sense.
Yeah. And to most ultimately, I guess down the line, it led to a decision where you said, I'm going to file for bankruptcy. And interesting, in the UK, there's a very different perception. In fact, maybe it's much more challenging to do that. But in America, when you did it, did you feel any shame? Was there relief or a bit of both for you?
A little bit of both. I heard of bankruptcy a little before I filed, but obviously nobody talks about it. It's kind of like a taboo type of like subject, because obviously when you hear bankruptcy, it's like you're giving up everything, you're losing everything. Yeah. But there's so many different chapters in between where you keep things, lose things, give up things to cover the debts. So I definitely didn't have any shame going into it too. I think especially since I posted that video before I filed for bankruptcy.
Yes.
I kind of am like an open book. So I didn't have any shame to it. And I definitely felt very much relieved after I had done it.
And that first time you went to court, I understand that you were the youngest person there. What was it? How did it feel like?
It was, I'd say that was like definitely more like a shameful thing in a sense. Like, it was definitely surreal, me being the youngest person, but I also didn't look too much into it just because since there were so many people in the room, I was just one of many people who were going through basically the same thing that I was.
But why do you think, Kylie, that Gen Z has more debt than the generations before? What's changed?
I mean, I definitely say things in the economy fluctuating. I mean, prices going up insanely and getting fewer quantities, I feel like, and things that we've bought in the past. And I just think social media is an insanely huge influence in that stuff, especially when it comes to shopping or stores coming out with sales or new collections
TikTok
for the seasons.
And
exactly, TikTok shop and things like that. And then all in all, I mean, education as well is insanely expensive over here, too. So I feel like all three of those kind of coincide within each other.
So on that first video, when you'd recorded it and you're about to click post on your TikTok, how nervous did you feel about that?
A little bit, just because I was so hesitant. Like, from when I had built up this debt, I did I don't want to say like lived like an extremely lavish lifestyle, but I was like, splurging on concerts and trips. And a lot of people would see that and they would, I don't think people really understood how I was able to fund things like that. So actually like posting that was kind of just like letting myself go in a sense with, here's how I've actually been doing all of this and what it's basically come down to.
Would younger you from like a year ago been surprised that you've turned this difficult sort of debt story into something that's actually a positive for others and also an income stream for yourself?
100%. 100%. I've like kind of always wanted to dive into that like social media world and kind of be a part of it, but I just never knew how. So I feel like that video of me being, open, an open book, being honest about it was definitely the kickstart to like the rest of my page and videos.
So in terms of bankruptcy, obviously in the UK and America, there's slightly different procedures, but what did it mean for you practically, and what are the sort of myths around it? You didn't briefly mention it earlier.
Yeah, so with bankruptcy, I feel like a lot of people, basically say like, you have to give up at you have to sell some assets, you have to give up a car, you have to give up a house, but there are so many different chapters, and the one that I chose, I don't know if it's different over there, but over here it's called a Chapter 7, and it's basically any basically credit card debts, medical debts, school debts that you have, you can pay off while keeping, a car note, your house, and things like that. I have a car note myself, so I was able to keep that with the Chapter 7. Other chapters, you might have had to have been able to give that up in order to cover some of the debts that you owe.
Okay, thank you for sharing that distinction for us. So, where are you now on your financial journey?
So I am about, I want to say, close to 6 months since I filed for bankruptcy. I've kind of just recently, by recently, I mean about like 3 months ago, kind of started to get in the swing of things of, starting to save and invest and things like that. I feel like after bankruptcy, it was more of playing a game of catch up of like, okay, I paid that off. Now I have to focus on, my main bills and things like that. But saving has definitely been a priority for me. And all in all, the way I look at spending money has changed my mind drastically since then.
So with that in mind, if you could go back to your younger self from a couple of years ago, what message would you tell younger Kylie?
Save and just be more mindful. There's so many things that I even bought, a year ago with the credit cards that I don't even own now. So I think using your brain a little harder when it comes to buying things and what you think would be worth kind of a lifelong purchase.
Well, thank you, Kylie, so much, because I think I'm sure listeners, some of experiencing debt, would have found your perspective really honest and refreshing. And if you wanted to follow your journey and support you and learn, where's the best place for them to find you?
Instagram, TikTok, if you are able to display my
And
TikTok,
what's your handle?
it's Kai Does Life. So KY Does Life.
Thank you so much, Kylie Scallard. Debt influencer from across the pond in America. Thank you so much for joining us on Broke and How to
Thank
Fix It.
you.
After the break, we're really privileged to have Jake Humphries, who's a well-known sports broadcaster, podcaster, author, and entrepreneur. So you'll definitely want to come back for that conversation.
Broke and How to Fix It with Bobby Seagull.
So my guests now will be familiar to millions of people across the UK. So Jake Humphrey is known as one of the country's leading TV presenters, from hosting children's telly early on in his career to fronting Formula One, presenting Premier League and Champions League football. But you know what? He's actually much more than just a broadcaster. Jake is an entrepreneur. He's the co-founder of a media production company, Whisper, co-host of a successful podcast, a high-performance podcast. He's an author. He's someone who spends loads of time on charity within the community and young people. And he also spends a lot of time thinking about the psychology of success, including the financial side of big life decisions. Gosh, I feel exhausted by that intro. But Jake joined us today to talk about his career, the pivots, how he manages financial uncertainty, and something many people don't expect to face, this suddenly having to manage a large lump sum of money after a major life event. So Jake, welcome to Broke and How to Fix It. So Jake, you've had a really fascinating career journey. I followed it from the very start. So in terms of financially, how do these transitions look like to you?
Well, look, Bobby, I'll be really honest. I think people sometimes look from the outside and think, wow, you've ended up on kids' TV. You must be financially stable, or, you know, the world of Formula One must have been good for you financially, or even BT Sport. And I, like, there's no doubt about it. Like, I come from a small family in Norfolk. My dad was a charity worker, my mum was a teacher. And as a kid, you know, clothes came from jumble sales. There were very few foreign holidays. When we finally managed to go on a foreign holiday, we would drive on a ferry to a campsite in France. You know, we were not an affluent family. And I think that's probably left me in a position where I'm always careful with money. Like, there are two things that stress me out, right? Health and finances. Yeah. And I lie awake at night worrying about my health and the health of my family. And when my finances aren't in good shape, I also, like, I am a catastrophizer. I do lie awake at night, you know, thinking, are things going to be okay? And I hate the uncertainty. I'm not good with uncertainty, right? Which is interesting when you think that I walked away from a career on kids' telly, then a career as a broadcaster to create a podcast. But I suppose the drive to do what really matters to me has probably been the biggest thing in my life. So I've always then made it work from a financial perspective after that, but it hasn't been easy. And I think that I've often been, I think, quite lucky that I've seen there's a potential issue down the road, and somehow it's managed to conspire that things have been okay for me. And I feel lucky from that sense. But I think for a lot of people, Bobby, and the reason why you talk about this so well and do so much like this is, like, finances are stressful because people don't understand them, because people don't talk about them. So the more that me and you can have a conversation like this where I'm honest and say it causes me stress, I think the more powerful it is for people that are listening.
Absolutely. Again, with that uncertainty, obviously you move from your sort of stable broadcasting roles into building a business. How did you sort of feel comfortable with the financial risks involved?
Well, when we first, so the biggest business that I've created is Whisper Group. You know, we've got about 300 staff.
It's incredible, that business, but well done. Just like, I didn't realize the extent of it till I checked it out. I was like, wow.
So, I mean, we had a good year last year. We turned over £100 million in turnover, a profit of 10 million. It's the largest independent production company in the UK, if not Europe now. And we've actually just done a deal where we've bought back the 30% that Sony owned in a management buyout. And I think that doing something like that was not really a risk for me because I always had my career. I give a lot of credit to Sunil, who's my co-founder and the CEO, who walked away from his job as a producer to create Whisper Group. So I suppose that I was aware that there would be financial challenges. Like, COVID is a really good example. So during COVID, we hadn't really taken much money out of the business. We'd saved a lot. We'd been really sensible. But we still would have lost that business within 6 months if it wasn't the government furlough scheme. And what we actually did for our staff was Sunil took no salary. We didn't pay ourselves any dividends. And we made a big lump of money available for staff who couldn't afford to drop their wages down to 70%. And we would then use our own money to top it up to 100%. So what I've always tried to be from a financial perspective is fair and honest and equitable. You know, the High Performance Podcast, for example, 20% of that is owned by the staff that work on the show. And I love that because I think they should be rewarded for their own success. And I think if we have this view of money where everyone can win, then I think it's a really powerful way to think about money.
Yeah, I think that, again, you rise and lift other people with you. That's such a powerful lesson for life and business and relationships. So, like, there'll be people listening to us now who are thinking about changing careers or starting something on their own, a bit like your podcast, but they're worried about that financial uncertainty. What would you say to them, you know, at that moment when you're like, okay, I'm going to take the plunge? What advice would you give them?
Well, I've always thought in life I'd rather be a failure than a coward, right?
I love that.
So you do have a choice, and it is scary.
Yeah.
But the most incredible thing in life, from my perspective, is to do something that scares you. Like, I do believe that the human existence should be challenging. I think it should be difficult. I think you should be pushed to your limits. I think you you should feel a sense of nervousness and anxiety at times, because I think that's healthy. But I also think that you need to feel protected. And when people are making a big change in their life that requires a financial change as well, or maybe something's happened to them, because I think I think when people are employed, Bobby, they kind of think, well, I'm never really going to have a big financial gear change in my life. It's not going to be a big sort of moment where I suddenly either have more cash in my bank or less cash in my bank. But you think about selling a house. You know, suddenly you have a lot of money sitting in your bank account, maybe for the long term if you're downsizing, or for a short term. A family member dies and you have inheritance, or you're made redundant, or you retire. All of these things can completely change your financial picture. And I think sometimes we feel a bit alone. And I'm keen to talk to you about some work that I'm doing with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, which I know that you will be well versed in because you are
Absolutely.
well versed in these kinds of things,
Yes.
to remind people that if they do have one of these moments where suddenly they do have more cash in the bank than usual, that money, as long as it's with a UK authorised financial provider, protected by the FSCS up to £1.4 million,
That's a huge amount,
their
isn't
high balance protection scheme. So I think that stops people panicking,
it?
fearing what to do with the money, making rash, quick decisions because they're worried about having that amount sitting in their account. But even if you don't have that big sort of financial windfall moment, the FSCS also protects people's eligible deposits from £1 up to £120,000. So there is someone who's got your back, there is some protection. And then I think people can have peace of mind as long as they're with a, you know, an authorized financial provider. And I know that you would certainly recommend
Absolutely.
people make sure they are. I think once you know that that's the position you're in, it calms you down from a financial perspective, which I think is important. And then you can make far more creative and ambitious decisions.
So with these like sudden financial windfalls that people receive, why do you think they're more common than people realize? Because
Because I
again,
think that we think that a financial windfall is what happens when you win the lottery, right? You're a
That's very true.
professional footballer or whatever. We actually forget about the fact that, you know, a lot of us have family members who will pass away, and there will be some money that comes our way when that happens. I also, the other thing I'm really passionate about here, right, actually, is we talk about the big financial windfall, and it's really important that that money is protected, and it's great that it is for 6 months, like you don't need to worry about that. But also, if you've only got £500 in your bank account or £2,000 in your bank account, then you cannot afford to lose that money. Like you are
Absolutely.
in a position where that money is really, really important for you to be able to feed yourself, your kids, pay your rent, whatever it is, pay your electricity or gas bill. And that's why I think it's so important that that money is actually protected. It's not about it. Obviously, protecting the big sums is really important, but
Absolutely.
also protecting the smaller amounts of a few hundred pounds is just as vital because in that position, people need that money.
Yeah, they do. So these obviously major life events, and they can get potential windfalls. Obviously, we think about there's the money side, but there's the emotional side. How does that impact people when they have these sort of windfalls?
Well, the way it impacts people when they have these windfalls is uncertainty. And I've already said, like, I don't like uncertainty. Now, I think we, and I've spoken to many friends of mine who've had exits from businesses. So they've built up a business over 10 or 15 years. And someone like me, who's in the process of the build rather than the process of the exit, I dream of that moment as like a halcyon, joyful, everything's now fine. The friends I've spoken to that have been through it say that actually their mental health takes an absolute battering when you walk away from a business because you lose your sense of purpose. And I think sometimes we think more money equals more happiness. It isn't true. More certainty creates more happiness. And, you know, my message to people is you can be certain that your money is protected if you've got it in the right places. So just once a year, look where your money is and make sure it's in the right places. And then it's kind of one less thing to worry about in a life where there are a lot of things to worry about.
Yes, there are.
Our money shouldn't be one of them.
And when people get these large sums, why do you think they struggle to manage them? Because in theory, you think, oh, I've got 120K. It's good news. But actually, a lot of people, I think they find it challenging.
Yeah, well, I think that sometimes we think the money is kind of more than it is. You know, if someone has £1 million in the bank, wow, they must be set for life. Well, if you're not earning, then you're probably not. It only takes one or two big things that you buy, and suddenly everything looks a bit different. I also think that, you know, we're a product of our upbringing, right? So if you haven't had a conversation with your family about financial literacy as a young person, I think you can get overexcited. And we see the stories all the time, right? Lottery winners that blow 7 million quid in
Gosh,
a couple of years because they just didn't expect the money, didn't know how to deal with it. Some unsavory characters come out of the woodwork. They make a few wrong financial decisions. Someone appears who promises them the world on a totally risk-free basis. We both know those deals aren't ever going to come off. So I think it puts people in a position that they're just not used to, and that can bring real challenges for them.
So, Jake, actually, on that financial literacy, are there money lessons that you'd wish you'd learned earlier on in your career?
100%. I do think if I'd have, you know, I was never great at maths at school, but I was good enough to get by and
pass.
Yeah,
I think
my
good
test.
Enough is the key thing I always say. You've got to be good enough, that's all.
Exactly, good enough. And you'll know this as someone that's been in the classroom a lot. But I think what certainly, I think it's a little different now, probably not different enough, but certainly in the 80s and 90s, nobody was teaching us how to budget. Nobody was teaching us how profit and loss worked. Nobody was explaining the difference between gross and net. Nobody was explaining what turnover is compared to EBIT. You know, there was none of these really valuable conversations.
Yeah.
And I think we're entering a world now where young people are not going to have a job for life.
No,
right.
Not.
A lot of them are going to be self-employed. A lot of them are going to be self-starters. A lot of them are going to be part of this creator economy. And you need to be financially literate. You need to know how income and expenditure can work in your favor or against you. And, you know, I remember when, you know, COVID came, I suddenly realized that the thing that I thought was the most powerful thing in my life, which was this amazing business with hundreds of staff, was the most vulnerable thing in my life, because you can very quickly get into financial difficulty when you've got, you know, large sums of money coming out of a business account every month. So it's been a real education for me, and I've kind of had to learn as I've gone along.
Yes.
And I wish, Bobby, that I knew at 48 what I knew at 28 or even 18.
Yes.
I think I made some different decisions earlier on. I probably would have got going in business earlier.
Yeah, but again, I always think life's a journey, and we learn by making mistakes.
There's a great phrase, right, which is, don't be disappointed by not knowing the things that only time could teach you.
Yes, I love that. I always think about that. So, Jake, we're going to end by a few quick fire questions. So just a sentence answer on sort of your approach to money and finances. Are you ready here? We're going to stop.
I am
time
very
here.
Ready.
Okay. So the biggest financial mistake and what it cost you?
My biggest financial mistake was trying to launch a high performance app and what it cost me hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Thank you. One money rule you live by?
Make sure you've got 6 months' worth of outgoings sitting in your bank account.
I love that. That's a rainy day fund. The best piece of financial advice you've ever been given?
Best piece of financial advice that I've ever been given is look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves.
Tesco would be happy with that. That's a good... three more to go. If you had to start all again tomorrow with £1,000, what would your business idea be?
I would... that's such a good question. I think I would lean into what I already know.
Yeah.
I would lean into the world of media, and I would spend £1,000 creating a course on how to talk effectively and how to be a great public speaker, and then I would use my socials to sell the course.
Yep, I'd sign up to that course. Spending, are you frugal or a big spender?
I think I'm frugal, but also a big spender. So I don't like to just throw away money willy-nilly, but if there's something that I really want, I bought myself an Aston Martin for my 40th birthday. And that's probably the biggest. That's also probably my biggest financial mistake as well, to be honest.
So actually, on that, is it something that you used to waste money on that you don't anymore? So is that your Aston or?
yeah, it would be my Aston Martin. Yeah, I'm glad I owned it. I felt like James Bond for 2 years, and then that was it. It went.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Jake Humphrey. It's been a real pleasure. Again, an honour actually speaking to someone that's, you've done broadcasting, you've worked in the charitable sector, you're an author, podcaster, and also. You seem like one of life's good guys. Actually, we're all cheering you on. Thank you for your words.
Oh, mate, you're so kind. I really appreciate that. And look, Bobby, I know the amount of work that you've done to educate young people in the financial money space, and that will change lives going forward. So well done for all you've done as well, mate. The feeling is mutual.
Well, welcome back to Broke and How to Fix It on FUBAR Radio with me, Bobby Seagull. So we've had three genuinely really insightful interviews with Fee Titus, founder of Coco Financial, Kylie Scarlatter, a debt influencer, and Jake Humphreys, the broadcaster and entrepreneur. It's time now for our money myth hot take section, where we challenge a commonly held belief or vile piece of advice. And this week, the myth is, buy now, pay later is free money. Well, is it free money? We're going to find out, because I think the reality is that buy now, pay later is ultimately still debt, and it can quietly nibble away and ultimately destroy young people's and older people's credit scores. Because while buy now, pay later feels harmless because the payments can be quite small, ultimately financially, it sort of does behave like debt. Because the way it works is it encourages people to spend their future income today. And this ultimately, I think, preys on psychology. Because let's say you go into a shop and you see, and again, I'm a West Ham fan, I might see a really fancy West Ham jersey. And it's, let's say it's a really pricey premium one. It's 120 quid. But on the shop till it says, buy now, pay later. Four payments of £30. So in my head, I might be thinking, oh, actually, 120, probably can't afford that right now. But 30 quid, four payments, that sounds doable. It sounds cheaper. So you end up buying something that perhaps you wouldn't have bought had it been 120 on the till. And the reason why this can be damaging is if you miss payments, you can end up harming your credit score, which we know that can play havoc if you're applying for loans or applying for mortgages. And also missed payments can trigger late fees. And then this means that ultimately that £120 jersey could cost significantly more. And I think a hidden danger of buy now, pay later is when I might buy that £120 jersey, but then I go into another shop and I see a cute handbag and I think, oh, my girlfriend could do that handbag. How much is it? £150. Can't afford that. Oh, but actually it says five payments of 30 quid. I can do that. I think, you know, I can afford 30 quid per week or 30 quid for my girlfriend. And then I've got a second buy now, pay later. And then another shop you go in and you see another item. Oh, here's a pair of shoes. My mum needs a pair of shoes. It's 200 quid. I can't afford that. But it's five payments of 40 quid. And many people actually run multiple buy now buy now, pay later plans simultaneously. And this is where the damage happens. And I always tell people, young people and older people, if you wouldn't buy it on a credit card, think twice before buying it on buy now, pay later. So the myth of buy now, pay later, it's free money. I think we've smashed that one. Each week, we give you one move that can take your personal finance on its next step. And this week, it is find out the interest rate on your highest debt. Really simple, because you might not actually know. And I'll tell you why this is important. Because most people will know their balance, or at least have a rough sense of maybe I owe 3 grand or 5 grand or 10 grand. But if you ask people, what is their interest rate? I think most people are not entirely sure because these things can change. But this is the number that matters. And I'll tell you why. Let's say you've got a 3 grand debt on your credit card and it's a sizable interest of 25%. That could cost £750 a year if it's left unpaid. So the simple step for you as a listener is to just go on, open up your banking account, scroll into the app, check what your credit card payment is, whatever the loan is, and find the APR. That's an annual percentage rate, which is equivalent of a percentage rate plus any fees they have. And if that rate seems high, you do have options. You know, you could transfer your balance, you could look into repayment plans, or what you could do is overpay on the highest interest debt first. And in fact, there's a phrase for this. It's called avalanche payments, where you look at all your debts and you find the one with the highest interest rate and you pay that first, because that is what is costing you. Or be on the flip side, there are some people that do a method called the snowball, where they look at all their debts and they pick the smallest one first, and they do that as like a little psychological win. But if you're trying to make real financial debts hits into it, look at the largest interest payments that you're making. Because ultimately, if you don't know the interest rate on your debts, you can't fix that number. So go on, find out what your highest debt interest is. And we have come to the end of another episode. And this week, we've had Fee, Kylie and Jake, who shared really valuable insights into the world of debt, entrepreneurship, social media, and hopefully giving you practical tips and truths that you can take away into your daily lives. So thank you so much for listening to Broke and How to Fix It on Fubo Radio with me, Bobby Seagull. So make sure we see you again next Monday at 4 p.m. where we can continue your personal finance journeys.
That was Broke and How to Fix It with Bobby Seagull.